Hello and welcome to Tim's take on the Bad Wolf Convention in Birmingham, UK. Today, the 12th of July 2008, otherwise known as the show with two intros, and this will become clear when you hear what is next on the show, because the original plan for today had been to record as many of the interview panels at the convention as possible, but what with one thing and the other, and another, I only recorded Terry Malloy's at the beginning of the day. So I will, next on the show, bring you that in full. Terry talked initially about working on The Archers radio soap on Radio 4. He's just come back from an Archer's cruise, and he tells you some of the activities on that, and then he goes on to talk about both working on Doctor Who on TV, and the big finish is which he has done, and the opportunities it's given him to expand further on the character of Davros. Later in the day, I was able to get in the autograph room, and I got Kai Owen, who plays Reese in Torchwood's autograph. I got Georgia Moffat, the Doctor's daughter's autograph, and I met up with Terry Malloy and got his autograph, and I was able to ask him whether doing Davros's voice is wearing to him. Does he have to, like, pause now and again to have a drink? Does it damage his voice? And he said no, because he's sort of developed a technique for it that it doesn't do his voice any harm. Now, because I didn't manage to record any of them, I'll just tell you who else I saw on stage throughout the day. Well, the day finished with Peter Davison and Georgia Moffat on stage, which sadly I only caught the tail end of, but I did manage to shoot some video that will be up on my YouTube within the next few days. We had also a very interesting talk from Mike Tucker and Matt Irvin, the effects guys. Mike showed us an extended cut of the behind-the-scenes footage that was shot for the Doctor Who boxed set of a couple of years ago, and so we got to see work being carried out on the first Dalek from Dalek, and the model of an apartment block that was or block of flats, as it were, that was blown up, and also some intriguing insights into the Big Ben spaceship crash from way back in season one. As I say, I only caught part of Peter Davison, Georgia Moffat's panel at the end of the day, but they did talk about what it was like working together, and there was a jokey aside at one point when they covered a scene that had been in the sitcom, the short-lived sitcom that Peter did for BBC Two, where he playing her character's dad was giving her a driving lesson, and I think between takes this became Peter Davison taking the part a little too seriously and having whole arguments about how you ought to play the scene, how you really ought to be driving, and so on and so forth. So yeah, I think that sums up my day fairly well. Also, bumped into someone that I've met at a previous Doctor Who event, Bev Manton from Rochdale in Yorkshire, who's a big Paul Darrow fan, was there. And she'll be staying the night and seeing through the whole event, and be attending tomorrow as well. But I've headed home, having not caught the whole event, but as you'll hear in the second intro to this week's show, you'll hear why that is. And so I'll take you now into intro number two, recorded by me about 11 hours ago, roughly speaking, at midday today. And I'll say goodbye now because that's about pretty much it for the show. You'll hear the full recording of Terry Molloy's panel, and I will catch you on episode 5, which will probably be covering the London Film and Comic Con, which I'm attending next weekend. Hello, and welcome to Tim's Take On Episode 4, Tim's Take On the Bad Wolf Doc 2 convention, which I'm running singularly 90 minutes late for. I, instead of getting here at 10 a.m, I got here about midday, because there is no free bus running from Birmingham New Street Station. There is a paid one just round the corner, which I managed to lose. But now coming on stage is Terry Molloy, and so I'll just keep recording, and we will at least hear Terry Molloy, having missed Georgia Moffat, Peter Davison, and Kai Owen.
Are we all good? You should come forward and go into the crowd. Just in the back, move forward and we'll get a run in going. It'll be fantastic. Right, okay, without further ado, please welcome the wonderful Mr. Terry Molloy! With head and hands. Over here. If you want to get on in life, get ahead. Yay! Somebody had. Yes, he did. He did. Oh, this is a bit bizarre, this couch scenario. A spring's gone in this side, that's for sure. So, how are we, Terry? You've all times, because you've just back from cruising around the Scandic and Arctic.
I have, yeah. I've been up in the North Pole for the last nearly 3 weeks. Yeah.
Only you would go to the North Pole and get a tan.
Well, hey, listen, I tell you, I got back to Dover, I thought, what's all this wet stuff? It's unbelievable. I mean, we had blue skies all the way through. And I mean, I've got a picture of me on the Longyearbyen Glacier, which is 600 miles from the North Pole, in my shirt, sweat pouring down my face, and snow up to my knees. I mean, they're absolutely fantastic.
It was brilliant. Well, just explain, you were away doing an Arcturus cruise.
It was, yeah. And we do two a year with Fred Olsen. And this was the Northern Cruise. There's another one in August, which goes around the Med. And the next one I'm going to do is March of next year, which goes down to Casablanca.
Cool. So how does that compare to that fan experience compared to this one, in terms of Doctor Who fans and Archers fans? What's the experience like in terms of the different Doctor Who conventions?
Archer's fans are just so terribly nice and polite, you know, and they tend not to dress up as the characters because nobody knows what we look like, which is rather useful. I'd say it's an Archer's cruise. It's not specifically for Archer's listeners. It's actually what you might call added value. Oh, yeah, go and put him up there because he's looking a bit lonely down there, poor thing. It's sort of like added value to a cruise that's already happening. It's like an arts club add-on to the package. So they have, you know, a watercolour expert on and a naturalist talking about birds. And we're there to provide a bit of insight into how the Archers is made as a programme, which we draw them people in during the course of the cruise.
You do something really interesting. I think it's pretty cool, actually, that you do scenes, you act out scenes with the guests, don't you, the fans that are there?
We get one of the Archers writers who writes a very specially written script for the boat. It'll never be broadcast. It's purely for the boat, and it involves usually the three characters that we've got on board, and then extra characters that the people on board take on. They, you know, we get actors that need to help as actors and as sound effects people, because we do a big sound effects session with one of the audio supervisors. And also we leave the last five lines blank, so they've got to write the ending to it. So it's really quite exciting. It involves people on all sorts of different levels, you know, where they might want to actually get involved. It's great fun.
It's funny what you said. I suppose Plans of Big Finish would feel the same way, that one the next thing they do in the Archer's website is that you have to actually click to reveal the actor's face,
yeah,
so in case someone has an impression of what a character looks like in their head. Yeah. And that's a really nice touch.
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of people say, I don't want to know what the current characters look like. You know? I mean, everybody knows that Mike Tucker's, you know, 180 pounds of whipcord muscle and steely eyed killer, you know, which is exactly what I am. Don't laugh, all right? I am. It's good. It preserves the mystery for those who want the mystery preserving. Though, I mean, I've talked to fans and they say, well, actually, having met you, I incorporate that into what I visualise. And that's the great thing about radio. It's bizarre. I mean, I may have done a scene, and when I listen to the Archers, and I even listen to myself in the scene, yeah, I can picture the faces of the actors because I've known them for so long. But I don't see the studio, I see the location in my head. That is just the magic of radio, and why it's really is my favourite medium.
And plus, some of the actors, and I'll not say who, do have quite sexy voices, but when you look at their picture...
Well,
not completely you, because when you look at their picture, it's rather disappointing.
It is, yes, absolutely.
Their voices don't quite match up to what they face for radio, as Woody Allen once said.
Absolutely, yeah, very much so. So I mean, they are doing more now when they cast characters. They cast them to the age of a character and approximating what they would imagine the physical appearance of that character would be. I suppose the big bizarre thing for most people who actually met Jazza, who's a Scottish mate of Ed's, would be the fact that he's actually blind and has been blind since birth.
Maybe you saw that, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, this is amazing. So there's a radio actor who's blind and he can't read. He learns every line of his script. They send him a braille version, which he then vocally copies into a copier, which then plays it back to him constantly until he learns it, you know.
That's
and
funny.
He's stunning. I mean, he's such a good actor, is Ryan.
Yeah.
He really is.
Because one of the advantages of doing audio work is, and I remember doing it myself, is that you don't have to learn lines. It's great.
That's great. Although Lucy Davies, when she came into it, bless her, she'd never done radio before she actually learned the script. Because she wasn't sure. She wasn't sure whether, she thought, well, I better learn it just in case, you know. I mean, the fact is, you get in the studio and they're putting red pencils through all sorts of things and giving you new sheets and changing it around. So, I mean, you know, learning it'd be a waste of time.
It's about talking about sound effects. It's interesting because the Doctor Who episode of this series called Midnight, the one that was inside the train for the whole episode. Did you see that one?
No, I didn't.
The Confidential did a whole the whole episode was about sound and sound effects. And
right.
It's, I think I have little appreciation actually of the extent to which sound plays in these things and the impact and the importance of the sound effects.
It is. I mean, you can. I mean, we demonstrated this actually on the boat because Louise Wilcox, who came with us, she used to be one of the senior audio supervisors at the BBC until, you know, they decided they'd get rid of her, and so they got rid of her and hired her back the next day at three times the money because she was now a freelance. And she runs all the audio for Spring Watch and Autumn Watch and is going off to do live cat in Kenya, you know. So she knows audio inside out. And we actually did a scene which we just recorded in front of everyone and deliberately made some mistakes in it. And she actually recorded it on a little handheld, then immediately downloaded it into her computer, which has got a cut-down version of Sadie, which is the editing suite that they use at the BBC for radio. And then immediately edited that piece, took out the bits that were rubbish, and you know, smoothed it, showed them how they did it, then laid over the top of that two entirely different sets of effects, which changed the atmosphere of the scene completely. It, you know, with the, exactly the same words, you put a different ambience on it, you put different effects at various places to emphasise certain things, changes the scene completely.
If you're a fan of Big Finish, and there's a guy here called David Darlington, shake the man's hand, because he's an absolute genius as far as Big Finish are concerned. The sound, because that's the thing with Big Finish I don't get. Normally, as you know, when you do radio work, if you're doing a show off at the corner, you actually go off, back in, but Big Finish, not just talking to Mike, we'll do all that later. It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, at the mailbox now, here in Birmingham, where we do the arches and where I shall be later this afternoon, there is a specific area which is called the Snail, and it was created by Mark Decker, who sadly is no longer with us, who was senior audio engineer at Pebble Mill. And it is literally like a snail, and it's the dead room. It's not because most actors' careers end there, but in fact it's because that's where it got no acoustic. There is no bounce whatsoever. There is no hard surface. There's all these various sort of wedges of foam rubber which just bounce it everywhere except at the microphone. And the snail is so good that it's literally not much bigger than the size of this stage, but you could literally walk and bellow as loud as you like at one end of it, and on the microphone it'll sound as though you're on the other side of a field. You know, hello there, Mike, you know. But you're actually, wow, giving it welly at the other end. Great what they can do.
Right, looking back over your career, we'll come to Doctor in a second, but I have to really indulge myself here, because recently I've had great fun on YouTube looking at old clips of Crossroads, because it's just so funny, it was hilarious. And you were at Crossroads for a while. Was it the Acorn Antiques that we've come to know and love?
It really was, yeah. I mean, so much that, I came into it to do one episode. This is when Butcher Bill Smethurst, who basically went around killing off Sirius, was in charge in the dying days of Crossroads. And they decided to bring back, what was the name of it? Stan Harvey. Who was by this time was in Germany or something or other, to come and collect his daughter and take her home. Well, of course, they asked Ted Clayton to do it, and he, quite rightly, having managed to get rid of the character after having been in it for years and years and years, said, no way. So Butcher Bill asked me to come and do a Ted Clayton lookalike or sound like, whatever, you know. So, it was pure Dallas, you know. This guy turns up and nobody really, you know, known him for years, actually susses it's not the same guy, you know, and they hand their daughter over to him as well, and he goes off to Germany with them. Wow, how weird is that? But no, I was standing at the side of the stage, because they call you down the scene before, so because they're very fast working and take you onto the set, and it was Jill and the other guy, Mark, thingy, Chance, and a scene where she had to bring a tea tray in, literally, had to carry a tea tray in, and they were going to have a cup of tea. And she was stood at the side, I'm going to stand up for this, it was so good, because she was stood at the side of the set, you know, with this tea tray, and the floor manager's there, and saying, we're going in 5, 4... and it was pure Acorn Antiques, you know, I was stuffing handkerchiefs in my mouth to stop myself from laughing. I was in the studio, you know.
Is the classic one, and do YouTube this, because it's true, I thought it was an urban myth, but it is true, the Angus Lenny one, where he plays the chef, Shuey McPhee, and he rushes in with a dessert, and he says, Mrs. Mortimer, those spiders didn't get there under themselves. And then he actually turns the thing to camera so that you can see the spider. It's
just stuck
bizarre. It's quite a surreal moment in television, yeah. It really is.
Yeah.
So when... We've recently had a new interpretation of Davros. When you came to take over the part in Peter Davison's Dalek story, did you watch? Did you do research? Did you watch Michael Wisher's performance? And
Yeah. I mean, I'd been working with Matthew Robinson on a series down at TBS, and which involved a lot of sort of voices, and I was playing this lunatic DJ. It was a sort of cross between Tony Blackburn and Mike Reed, and sort of very smashy and nicey. And he said, you know, have you ever watched Doctor Who? I said, oh yeah, I used to watch it, you know, when I was a kid, you know, well, a teenager, because it came out when I was about 16. He said, so you know about the Daleks? I said, yeah, I've seen the Daleks, you know. He said, what about Davros? I said, I'm the clue. No, I don't know. Oh, he's slipping off into the distance there.
Trapped myself in there.
This will come in. Because no, I'd stopped watching. I mean, I watched it during Patrick Troughton's days and then kind of drifted away from it. So he said, well, come and look at these tapes. And he dragged me in and sat me down and we sat through Genesis. And he sort of said at the end, well, do you think you could recreate that character, you know, that what Michael has done? And, you know, like any actor worth his salt, said, well, no, I couldn't possibly. He's far too good. And, oh, don't ask me to do it. I jumped at it and said, yes, you know. As I'm sure Mr. Bleach has done since. And that was it. And so I sat and I examined what he was doing. I mean, I sat and watched it, and I thought, how's he doing that? And a lot of it was actually informed later on when I got the mask and I realised why he was talking in a particular way. And I realised he had a way of delivering, which was part of what the character was. And, you know, you've got to realise in those days, you know, we had these foam rubber masks. They were not very mobile. You had to work really hard. And that was the key, in a sense, the key to when we did a new mask and I tried it on, I realised you had to talk very, very particularly in order to get any movement whatsoever. And that was, in a sense, what Michael was doing. He was having to talk in a very pedantic and staccato sort of way. And then you begin to bring the voice down in pitch a little and still have that staccato way and bring in psychosis. And slowly you become Davros and wish to destroy and exterminate the Doctor. And that's how he occurred. That's how it's in the voice. The character is there in the voice. So it was like doing a radio play on telly, which is great.
You more than anyone through I, Davros and the audio that you did, you've really kind of investigated the psyche of the character and where he came from and why he became the way he was. And that's quite an interesting process, wasn't it?
Very much so. It's something I wanted to do because, I mean, obviously we did three telly versions with Peter, with Colin and with Sylvester. And there's only so far you can go. We did try to expand it in Revelation and bring in some of the black humour that Davros has. You know, about feeding people their own relatives, you know, and stuff like that. And but then, you know, there were some years passed, and I just happened to do an interview for a sci-fi magazine about my thoughts about Davros and about villains in general. And you know, and I was basically saying, well, villains aren't born villains. They don't, you know, come out of the womb going, whoa, you know, and I want to take over the world. There's a journey. There has to be a journey from man to monster. That's not, you know, he was looked like just like us. The Khalids were Aryan race, very beautiful people. So there must have been a journey. And Gary had written a similar thing at the same time. Both came in, and he rang me up. He said, look, we seem to be sitting on the same wavelength. He said, would you be interested in doing a story with Davros and the Doctor but doesn't involve the Daleks? And I said, well, yeah, I think because Davros can exist without the Daleks very easily. And the Daleks can exist without Davros. You know, the two come together because they tend to be a bit of a package. But I said it would be interesting to begin to explore some of his backstory, you know, backtrack and fill in some of the canon, which is what we did with Davros, the first one with Colin. And Lance Parkin wrote this wonderful script. And it worked really well, and so we went on from there with a couple of others, and then obviously we then came to think about doing I, Davros as a mini-series, and began to really look at the character of where he had come from, and one of the things that, you know, through the process of doing that, and Juggernauts, and Terra Firma, and the psychosis that was obviously there in him at this point in time. So, well, where did that start from? What was your starting point? And going back, I've very much felt that actually Davros was somebody who probably suffered from Asperger's syndrome. I mean, what we would know as Asperger's syndrome now, that he's totally and utterly brilliant mind, phenomenally laser-like mind. He and the Doctor have probably got the biggest brains in the universe. And that's why, in a sense, there is this symbiosis between the two of them, that they realise that they've got their own intellectual equals there. Also, they've both realised they're on their own. You know, they are single... But Davros is this single-minded, you know, which is very much part of an Asperger's thing, that is focus. Very difficult to relate to people, you know. Can relate, but it's... The focus is there, and if anybody gets in the way, they get trampled on in order from getting from A to B. And that was the starting point. I'm not saying that's the whole thing, but that was the beginning of it. And then we wrapped this, obviously, around this, very much like I, Claudius, this matriarchal family with the pushy mother who's got the brilliant child who wants him to do fantastic things and jumps on all over people in order for it to happen. And then Davros, you know, his own single-mindedness, beginning to be aware that there is another way of achieving his single-mindedness, not just through being a brilliant mind, but actually being a political animal and a fairly nasty pizza. But not that he doesn't believe it. I don't think any evil person really believes they're being evil. You know, I mean, like even in Revelation, the fact that he was solving the problem of hunger in the universe. Now for him, was, well, what's the problem? I'm feeding the universe. Yeah, okay, I'm feeding them their own relatives. What's that got to do with anything? Yeah, they're dead. They ain't going to feel it. You know, that percentage can't comprehend the morals of this. What's your problem? You know, yeah, I'm feeding people. So what? They're being fed. You know, and that's it's genius and evil genius. There's just that fine dividing line. Where do you jump off? It's when you suddenly cross the line you're not aware of, and you do something which everyone else goes, whoa, no, step too far, too much information. But within that mind, it's a totally logical progression, and it's one you've got to run.
Revelation's actually my favourite of the three you did. I think it's the most interesting story and a very forward-thinking story for the time, because it was quite edgy.
Very.
The style in which Graham Harper directed it.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, let's just go and have a Graham Harper love fest, because the man is just fantastic.
Yeah.
And I sit down. Did you enjoy Revelation? What was your favourite of the three?
Revelation. I mean, not only because we began to explore, you know, and it was more of a Davros episode than a Doctor Who episode. I mean, you know, bless him, Colin kind of wandered in at the end and sort of mopped up, you know. It had been mainly Davros and Eleanor Bron and William Gaunt.
Cast
and
as well.
A brilliant cast, yeah. You know, Clive Swift, Eleanor Bron, William Gaunt. Yeah, I just went on. Alexis Sale, I mean, phenomenal. And a really good set design and a brilliant script by Eric. I mean, he'd done a really good job on it. It was a dark script, but it opened up all sorts of doors in all sorts of areas and had a real style to it, which Graham, you know, exploited brilliantly. Produce this really gothic, this gothic story.
Yeah, it was. I mean, in a sense, it's something we see the difference now in television to then, is that 80s TV is all very brightly lit. You know, and that story could really have done with a bit more intelligent lighting, just bring it down a little bit,
yeah.
Maybe more of that gothic atmosphere.
Yeah, they tried, but I mean, yeah, obviously, there's, you know, it's the days of the sparks when they, you know, they just turned it on, mate, and went off, you know. I said, that's the set, that's the lighting, mate. No, I can't change it. No, well, my job's worse to be that lantern, you know.
Tell me a bit more about Graham Harper and his style of direction, because he's just a force of nature, isn't he?
He's just a little bumbling little dynamo, basically. And I love him to bits. I mean, he's great. And in fact, I went down to Cardiff when they were finishing off this new thing. They invited me down to do a Doctor Who Confidential and met up with David, which was really embarrassing, actually, because I went in and they were just doing pickups in the TARDIS of David, and Graham was directing it, and I didn't realise Graham was there that day. But David knew I was, and he sussed me from the other side, you know. So when they came to a pause in recording, he dashed over and said, I tell you, how are you? Brilliant to see you. I said, great, really great, love to see you, David. He said, oh God, he said, it's been so long since we worked together. What? Hello. And yeah, we worked together on a radio play in 97 called The Sea by Edward Bond. You know, I'm like, oh, God, yes, we did. Oh, blimey. I totally forgot he hadn't. I mean, my perception of the sea was Anton Lesser and Rosemary Leach, because they were playing the leads. The rest of us were being villagers. But then I thought, yeah, of course, this is all pre-Casanova, pre-Doctor Who and everything, you know. But
he was probably in awe of you at that point.
Yeah, he possibly was. I mean, I don't know. Anyway, and still seemed to be, you know, in relation to that. But I then went over to Graham, and Graham didn't know I was there. And he was busy fumbling away at his, you know, doing his little things, you know. So I just stood in front of him. And he finally looked up and I said, all right, Gov, do you want me in the back of the shot or what? And his face just went... It could not compute. And he went... And then all this, you know, hello, hello, hello kind of stuff, you know. But, you see, I mean, I don't think he's ever forgiven me for Bergerac. Because after I'd done Davros... He invited me to do an episode of Bergerac, to play a film director in a thing called Sins of the Fathers, with Warren Clark being this German who was actually running an insurance scam and trying to get himself killed. And they gave me this script, and it was this very obvious camp American film director. I said, this is a load of nonsense. I said, I'm going to play him as a mad Irishman, if that's all right. And a friend of mine had just been working on Alien, and Harry Dean Stanton became great drinking mates. And Harry had given this friend of mine who was a floor manager at Pebble Mill his alien hat, his hat from Nostromo. So I said, hey, can I borrow that? So I borrowed the hat, so, you know, and I'd got my beard growing at the time, so I'd a little pair of dark black glasses and a cigar, so I looked very Spielberg-y, you know. And basically, we were working a lot in the background. We had script stuff to do, but generally, in most of the shots, Graham wanted us in the background. He gave me my own unit, my own BBC unit. We were actually filming stuff as a second unit, which they could then use in edit. So I was actually directing an actual unit. And he said, just get on with it, do what you want, you know, set up where you like, providing you're in the background of my shot, you do what you like. So I said, fine, okay. And there was me and Peter McCullough, and we were doing all this stuff and setting it all going. And it was 3 days into the shoot when he got the rushes back. He came to me, he said, you sod. He said, you're playing me. I said, yeah. I said, I was playing this mad Irishman, bouncing around. Yeah, lovely, great, Gov, come on, get in over here, Gov. Go on, Gov, lots of Govs in it, you know. And he said, yeah, there's nothing you can do about it now. Because I said, the guy said, I'll get you for this. Which he actually did. He cut me together right at the end of this party where we'd been filmed dancing with all these Page 3 girls. He cut it together so that me and Peter, my PA, were dancing with each other. He rang me up and said, gotcha.
Great one. And of course, you managed to get Doctor Who Without the Mask in Attack of the Cybermen with Colin again. So
yes.
Nice to work with Colin.
Well, I mean, I did Attack before I did Davros with Colin. So the first one was actually Attack. Again, this was Matthew Robinson. He just rang me up and said, would you like to be a real person for a change in Doctor Who? And I said, yeah, it'd be great. So, I seem to do Daleks and Cyberman.
Because
I've just done another big finish, a Cyberman one, with Sylvester. But this time playing a goodie. I'm a nice guy, Mr. Nice Guy for a change.
Mike Tucker.
Yeah.
Mike Tucker and Doctor
Who. No, Mike Tucker's not. No, Mike Tucker's, he's like, Derry's only got one eye.
Does anyone want to ask Terry a question? There's some questions from the audience. Anyone out there? Oh, come on.
Don't be shy.
I know there's one question you'll die to ask him. No? None whatsoever? Oh, well,
somebody over there.
Oh, there we have one there. There we go. I was going to give you a second to think there, but go ahead.
Hello?
Hello?
Would you play Davros again if they did another Doctor Who?
Well, they've got another Davros now, haven't they? Apparently.
You haven't seen that, have you, Terry?
I'm sad to say, or glad to say, I don't know. As I say, I've been out of the country for 3 weeks, so I've totally missed it. I literally stepped off the boat 2 days ago, straight into a production of Darwin at Cambridge, playing Charles Darwin. And then down here, and then I'm in studio all the rest of this weekend doing Archer, so I've not had a chance to go anywhere near it. I mean, obviously I've seen the chair, because I've got a picture of me with the chair when I went down to Honor, and I've seen pictures of it, you know, and Julie Gardner did, ring me up after it was being done to explain that they decided to go in a different direction with the character. So I assume that he was obviously going to be gay and tap danced a lot, you know. So I don't know. I haven't seen it. You'll have to tell me. I mean, you know, you tell me. I'm delighted that the character has come back, and I'm really pleased that the character, he had to come back at some point. My concern about the character coming back has always been, I suppose, because I'm in a proprietorial kind of way, that they are true to the character, and they retain that essence of the. The feasibility of the character, in a sense, rests on the intellectual battle between him and the Doctor. It's not a physical battle, it's an intellectual battle. And that is maintained. And, the rest, you know, I'm sure is history. I mean, I don't know.
But, yeah. It's quite difficult, isn't it? Because obviously you've taken the character to your heart. And I suppose it's, in a sense, the same as Peter and Colin and Sylvester watching Chris and David doing the Doctor.
Absolutely,
now,
yeah.
I took over doing it. Difficult. Let's be honest. It's difficult to see that.
Yeah, yeah. No, when it's become part of your life. I mean, yeah. If I hadn't done the character since 1989, I think, well, hey. But I mean, because I have done the character 10 audios with Davros in. I mean, I've developed the character, so I feel a sense of ownership of it. But yeah, I mean. Michael did it, he created it, you know. He then handed on, purely by chance, because he wasn't available, to David. Then they were going to bring him back to do it. I only got asked to do Davros because of a strike, which meant that they had to shift the whole schedule for that season forward 3 months. So where they were meant to be doing it at Christmas, they did it in March. By that time, Michael was in Australia, so he couldn't do it. The director who was going to direct Resurrection couldn't do it either, because he'd got another time slot. So Matthew came in to direct it. I was a friend of Matthew's and got pulled in, you know. So it was purely by dint of chance. The fact that JMT liked what I did and asked me back again and again is lovely, great, you know. But I took over the mantle. I have to hand the mantle on. It's not mine by right. It's up to them to decide who they want to play it, and if they've got someone they prefer more than me. I mean, I've heard things on the website, you know, they say, obviously they didn't want it because he's now too old. He's too old? Sorry, Davros is a young man, is he? He's, this feisty young, sprinter. That's obviously the new direction they're going up on, you know. I don't know, their decisions are their decisions, you know, but as I say, Julie did have the graciousness to actually ring me up and say, look, I want you to know before it becomes widely known that this is what we decided to do. And I just, what do you say? You just say, I'm delighted the character's coming back. Yeah, I happily hand over the mantle, you know, you can't do anything else, really.
But I think it's important to say that you do have a lot of affection for all the fans, because actors like yourself and Colin didn't just see the role in Doctor Who as another job they did, because you're one of the busiest actors in the country and you've been in the Archers for over 20 years.
35.
Is it 30? My God, is it all?
So well,
but yet you've still taken the character to your heart and you've kept that interest going. And I'm guessing, because I know what Big Finish pay, it's not just another job, it's something that you actually feel quite close to and devoted to.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the fans appreciate. Am I right there?
I do enjoy the work. I mean, when I took the first one, I thought this is a job that's 2 weeks, that's it, and then it came again and it came again, and at that time I had no possible idea that it would last as long as it has done, or that it would go in so many different directions. But that's been great. In the same way with the Archers, I joined the Archers. I was told I was going to be there for 5 weeks. 35 years later, I'm still there, and clogging on, and that's great, you know. But I mean, somebody said to me, actually, I did a MC'd a charity auction in Sheffield at the Cutlers Hall,
and somebody came up to Martin and said, do you realise that you've been in, you've been a major part of two of the most seminal programmes the BBC put out in, during the last century? I said, hey, less than the last century bit. You know, but it's actually true, yeah. I mean, the Archers and Doctor Who are kind of so intricately woven in the fabric of the BBC output, you know, and I've been incredibly fortunate as an actor to have been in those and also met so many lovely people as a result of it, you know, because the fans in Doctor Who and the Archers, they share a common love of the programme that they have watched. And it's like being part of an extended family, which I delight in. I delight in coming to conventions. I delight doing the Archers ones as well.
And another thing which might surprise some of you out there, because we're very proud coming off the back of fantastic ratings in Doctor Who, 10 million odd viewers. How many people listen to the Archers?
At the moment, 6 million. 6 million a week. Okay, we get more ratings than EastEnders. We don't have their budget.
No.
We get cast and we do the average age of the average wage of an actor on the Archers is £7,000 a year. They could actually afford to pay every actor, and there's 62 actors in The Archers, they could afford to pay every actor for every episode of The Archers that went out at a reasonable wage, which would probably amount to about 70 grand a year, and still only just about dent Jonathan Ross's fee for half a year, you know, easily. Now, you know,
he doesn't get 6 million people tuning in.
He doesn't get 6 million people tuning in. No, The Archers, I mean, in its heyday, The Archers was getting 28 million. And it is very heyday.
Incredible.
Yeah, the BBC tried to deny it, but in fact, yes, they did kill Grace Archer off in order to blow ITV off the front pages. You know, they killed her off on the same night as ITV launched. And such was the power of the Archers in those days that it did. It wiped ITV completely. Front pages of all the newspapers were Grace Archer dead. Grace dies in fire. You know, nation mourns. It really was that big. Yeah.
And it still works. I mean, I listen to it and I don't know, I kind of don't know why it still works in the 21st century, but the writing is good and the performances, the characters are good and it still fits. You know, this little twee, it should be a twee 50s, you know, country life, but it's not
toilet. Because it has, and it always does, and still, and will continue to do it, accurately reflect the reality of living in a rural community. And any decade is in. People say, oh, it's all got a bit racy now. You say, hang about. You know, Jennifer Aldridge had an illegitimate child in the early 60s. That was big stuff. You know, Walter Gabriel owned an elephant and was done for drug running in the 60s. You know, Tom Forrest was up for murdering someone as the gamekeeper. You know, these were all, you know, serious. But they've got a really good team of researchers and writers who, they don't do the big splashy stories. They may be big and splashy within Ambridge, because they affect various people within Ambridge, but they're not the sort of rating-grabbing stories. They don't need to be.
No terrorist attacks in Ambridge or anything?
Not yet.
Well, you know.
Who knows? Yeah, well, but no, they don't need to play that ratings game that the telly soaps have to. So they can concentrate on what's actually happening in the farming community. Because that's what it started off as. It started off as an information, a drama information programme for farmers. Instead of Farming Today, they said we want a farming version of Dick Barton. Which is what happened, because the writers of Dick Barton created the Archers and then killed Dick Barton off, much to the chagrin of any Dick Barton listener who still hates our guts because we you know, displaced Dick Barton, you know. But we're doing it again now because we've got the Scary Fires. We're bringing it back. Dick Barton meets the X-Files.
Was it ever mooted of taking the Archers to television?
No.
Never. Do you think it would work?
No. No. No, absolutely. I suppose you could say Emmerdale is the closest they've come to doing something like that. But no, it couldn't, because it's very particular, again, very much in people's heads. That part of England is very much in people's heads. And yeah, there may be roses round the door in some people's minds, but there's also the angst and the problems as we've got at the moment, the TB and the herds, you know. It reflects what's happening. People say you jump on bandwagons. You know, like a couple of years ago, John Archer was done for trashing GM crops. And they said, oh yeah, well, you're jumping on the bandwagon because Melcher's just done it in Norfolk. Actually, the reality was that storyline had been prepared 18 months before.
because the agricultural story editor goes around talking to farmers, say what's coming up, he knows what's going to happen in the community, they build it into the long-term planning of the story. That's why The Archers is a success, because of the teamwork that they've got all around them, putting it together and making it absolutely true to life.
Good. Any other questions? Anyone got a question they'd like to ask too?
Yeah. Just before we do, we've actually got
a voice from the gods.
We've got a clip of the new Davros to show Terry.
Have you?
Right.
So it's going to have to be on the big screen, I'm afraid. So.
Oh, we'll get it here. Right.
We'll get there.
Okay, there we go.
What do you think?
I mean, yeah, good. I mean, very true to as Davros has been. I mean, God, I wish we'd had that prosthetic makeup in our day, because that was the main problem with that mask, having to fight against it, and to have all that prosthetics and be able to actually just use your face and act with it would have been great, you know.
Although I do think Davros naming the Doctor as Destroyer of Worlds is a bit rich. It's a bit caught in the kettle black, isn't it? He was about to destroy everything 30 seconds before that.
Was he?
Oh, yeah. Good. Oh, sorry.
I don't know. Has he? Oh, great. Right, lovely.
But he ends up owning, as you predicted, a nice little burlesque cabaret bar in New York.
Oh, excellent. Oh, good. Yes.
Doing quite a nice little turn.
A nice turn, yes.
Yes, he does. any other questions? So, we got that clip there. Any questions? We have a couple here, right? Okay, this gentleman here and then that lady there. So, come on, Doug.
Sorry.
Keep that.
Have you enjoyed working with Nick Courtney on the Scarefire CDs? Because they sound like a lot of fun to make.
They are brilliant fun to make. I mean, I'd never worked with Nick on Doctor Who. And, you know, the two of us just spark off each other. They are such a gas to do. I mean, we're having great to do with keeping our faces straight. And I mean, Simon, bless him, I mean, he's a documentary producer for Radio 1, where he's come from. I mean, his scripts are phenomenal, you know. I mean, I know he hones them and works very hard on them, which is why we don't put out more than, you know, one, possibly two a year. But everyone is a delight. I mean, we're doing another one at the end of this month, The Curse of the Black Comet. And, you know, I've been reading that, and it's just great. It just really, the idea of having these two octogenarians running a secret ministry, as I say, it's Dick Barton meets the X-Files, with these two decrepitudes, sort of, you know, and it's all lantern-jawed acting and terribly daring do, which is just so symptomatic of that time. It's great, and extraordinary characters, you know, Dave Benson just has a field day with Aleister Crowley especially, you know. We just have to have Aleister Crowley in every episode because he's just such an outrageously wonderful character. No, great fun to do, and I look forward to many more in the future.
Yeah, good question. The Scary Fire is fantastic. That was a great idea. Yeah. Really is wonderful. Further along there, someone had a question? Get that microphone along.
The original Genesis, which Michael created, Davros, was very parallel to Hitler and his regime. Do you think that as the character progressed, as you portrayed him, both on the audios and on TV, that he was like a Hitler-type character?
I mean, there are elements of that in it, and there are certainly elements in I, Davros, that would hark back to a Weimar Republic and a Republic of Dictators, which was a direct, you know, way that they looked at Genesis and doing it, that they were creating this intergalactic Weimar Republic. And and it's an obvious place to jump to initially, to say, well, he's a dictator, he's a ranting dictator. The obvious parallel for QED is Hitler, because that's the closest one we've got to that. Which is why, in a sense, I wanted to start to move away from it. He'd still have his rants. It'd still be there, partly to do with what I was saying about the Asperges, which I felt was a key element in there. That those rants were there, but they were part of who he was and the psychosis that he was having to deal with, which was beginning to take him over. And I mean, certainly when we did Terra Firma, where we very much focused on the schizophrenia that was happening within Davros's head, having created the Daleks, as to whether he was a Dalek or whether he was still a Khaled, you know. And it's interesting, when we did I, Davros, Lance wrote in this piece of Dal script, which he thought Gary's going to cut because he hates COD, you know, pretend foreign languages. And this Talubic Khalid Uthrikta Dalek, which is something that Davros discovered, this Dal, old, ancient Dal script, pre-Khaled, pre-Thal, the first race on Skaro, and the translation of which becomes Uthrikta Khaled, Talubek Khaled, Uthrikta Dalek, and so the men, Uthrikta Talubek Khaled, Uthrikta Dalek, shall become as gods. So Dalek, instead of what everyone was saying, but said that it's an anagram of Khaled, actually Dalek was an old Dal word for God. So, I mean, it's an interesting thing that it's this God, this sort of, you know, this kind of mystery and philosophy surrounding that kind of whole thing is tied in with, you know, the Weimar Republic. But we started to try and move away from it in the later TV ones. And also, you know, you kept elements of it there, but because the Khaleds were an Aryan race. In Davros, they wanted to take himself out because he's no longer a beautiful person. He looks awful to them. He looks horrific, you know, in their society. Brilliant mind, but please, you know, we can't cope with you. You don't look right. So still that element was there, but that's part of the society in which he grew up in. Does that answer your question?
Totally, I think. Any other questions? Yeah, we've got a couple. We've got one here at the front. We've got a microphone. Oh, there you are. Just one there. Gentleman, same going.
Hello. It seems that Davros had a level of charm when dealing with other characters. Now, was this charm due to his big intelligence and his possible feeling of need to make any connection, of any sort of friendship connection, or was it just all a means to an end? Would he sort of plot it in advance that I would be friends with this person, and then obviously overpower them through his plans?
I mean, my personal feeling is yes, he would utilise people to whatever end. I think he learned that. I mean, we certainly discovered it in I, Davros. He learned that political trick of being nice to me, because initially he would just stamp around and say, look, I want this and I want it now. But he realised it was a political game to play, to get people alongside him in order to get what he wanted and put himself in a position of power where he then couldn't need them any longer. You know, and he did that time and time again in the audios that we've done. And I think, yeah, there is that sort of quietness to his voice when he's actually sort of, but underneath it, he's gritting his teeth. He's saying, I've been terribly nice to you because I don't want to exterminate you yet, but to cross my path and I will tear you limb from limb. It's that close. It really is that, you know, turn the coin and he'd go, you know, really would.
Interesting. There was somebody else over there on the question. I think it was, yeah, that's, keep your hand up there. Oh, you got one back. We'll take the one back.
Yeah.
Oh. A young person, a little person. Off you go.
Oh.
Yeah.
In episodes where the Daleks have been, has Davros always been looking over them?
Has he always been looking over them?
Yeah.
It is an interesting one. The whole Dalek Davros thing. You know, I mean, Davros created the first Dalek in Genesis, which is how I, Davros ends. We go from him as a young lad, right up to the first Dalek saying, I am alive. And he didn't quite do it right, because you then get this breakaway faction, and you've got the renegade Daleks, you've got Davros's Daleks, and it's like he keeps on recreating Daleks in order to make them bigger, better, brighter, more effective, and more loyal killing machines for his cause. But they do exist on their own. They go off, they have, because he created them with minds of their own, they may have lots of areas of that mind taken out, like compassion, but they are thinking beings, sentient beings, and they can, you know, begin to create their own society, which isn't the way Davros is, so he goes off and does something else. And so they get into conflict with each other and with Davros. So he doesn't overlook all of them. He keeps on bringing out a new version time and again, but he's always there in the background. They're the ones, they come back to him when they've got problems, as they did in Resurrection, when the Mavellan virus. He was the only person who could solve that. They were trying to utilize him, but he was too brainy, and he utilized them for his ends, and of course, as always, escapes at the end.
Yeah, indeed. Now, there was someone in the middle there, but that's the hand up there. Keep your hand up, Doug, I'll come and find you with the microphone.
On the story called the Revelation of the Daleks, when Davros' head was on that white table, was it like sort of a second life support system when he was infected by the repellent virus?
When it was, in Resurrection?
Yeah.
Revelation.
Revelation.
Yeah,
when I was in the tank.
Yeah.
Now, the tank was, as he says, but a lure for the assassin's bullet. It wasn't Davros at all. It was I was doing it in order to make it look like it was Davros, but it was actually meant to be a pretend Davros that he'd set up in order to, make people think that's who the great healer was. But in fact, he was at the back, you know, somewhere else, pulling a few strings. So when they did shoot him, yes, that head just implodes, but it's not actually Davros. It was just a pretend Davros. Although it was me in that tank. God, that was awful.
Right, well, we're rounding up. You're off this afternoon to do some Archers pickups, aren't you? You're doing that.
I'm off at about 3 this afternoon. Yeah, I think I'm doing some autographs before then.
Yeah.
Then I'm back into the verdant fields of Ambridge once more.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, as ever, it's a pleasure having you here, Terry.
Charlie,
so
thank
please
you.
Please give your appreciation to Terry. Thank you.